Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman. Today we have two amazing people there. We have Kai Davis, our co-host that you're very well familiar with, and we have Thomas Cannon, who is working as an API and integration developer at Freckle Team. And in simple words, today we're going to be talking about technical documents that are built audience first and that are going to relieve your support workload for your SaaS. And Thomas reached out according to the best outreach standards that we discussed with Kai in the previous episode. And when I was reading his letter, it was literally like he was reading my mind, and he just left me no choice but to, you know, surrender to this wonderful topic. And, you know, I think it's going to be super valuable for SaaS founders. So, hey guys, hi Kai, hi Thomas.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, good to see the two of you.
Amazing. So, Thomas, why don't you tell us a few words, what you do as of today, and a few sentences of your life story?
Okay, so the work I do at Freckle is I'm the API and integrations developer mainly. So not only do I write integrations with other pieces of software that tie into Freckle, but I also have designed, developed, and built Freckle's new API from the ground up. And it's really, really fun. It's really, really fantastic. I'm going to toot my own horn for a little bit. I'm really proud of that work. And I also act as the liaison between the development team and the support team. So the support team has a question, they come to me, I help figure out if it's actually a bug or the best way to solve the problem from a technical standpoint, and our customers get great customer service for it. And that's another job I love. That's something that I really get to tap into. I've done customer support for years. I spent like 2 or 3 years working at a university help desk. So I'm used to dealing and helping just about anyone with a technical problem, and varying from I can't print to I poured an entire glass of water into my laptop. What do?
Amazing. And so you seem to be enjoying your hard situation at work very much, because I think, you know, handling support and handling all this documentation, it's not the easiest thing to do, especially because you have to be like the crossfire between several worlds, like your own developer world, support world, the customer world, and whatever else happens in the real world ever, like glasses of water. So how do you handle that?
The best way I found to handle that is to really have a good informal tone. Just being the best way that I found to write my technical documents is to basically speak them out, to talk them as if I was talking to another person. And then I just create different, more or less imaginary people. So if I'm dealing with a non-technical document and I'm trying to explain how a new feature works, then I imagine the kindest, most warm-hearted elderly grandmother you can imagine who is still technically competent. And I walk through how something works to them and the best way that they can go about using a new feature or how to set it up, not only at that moment, but on their own and in a way that they understand how the app works in a broader context. They gain an intuition for how software works and how our particular app works.
Absolutely. Kai, isn't that the same principles that we discussed for all kind of marketing and, you know, sales and whatsoever? Don't you see the same principle working?
Absolutely. Like, when Thomas was saying that, I was immediately thinking it's the same ideas I evangelize from the marketing side of the table. You want to make sure that you're talking to your customers in a way that's friendly, that's kind, that they could understand, that holds their hand and moves them forward. And in a sense, when I look at technical documentation of any sort, I always see it as an extension of marketing, because once you've had a prospect become a customer, sign up for your app, pay you money, you still have that job of making sure they have a pleasant time and making sure your technical documents hold their hand, lead them forward, answer their questions, solve their problems. That's still marketing. That's still making sure they don't throw their computer against the wall, cancel their account, and just start hating you because they don't know what to do. Good support documents are as important as a good marketing page.
I think they're kind of an extension of marketing, because once you're a serious prospect and you're researching the technical capabilities of software, you're eventually going to end up in the technical, you know, side of things, exploring the features and the documentation. So you really want to set that up friendly for the user. And that's where Thomas comes in.
Yep. And I can verify with proven experience that like that is exactly how we do things. When I know that when we're looking for software, we're looking for, okay, what's the next app that we integrate with? Before we do anything else, I look at the technical docs, and that's my vet of, okay, is this going to be something that we can feasibly pull off? Because if they don't have good technical docs, then I know it's going to be an upward struggle to get anything done, and it doesn't make sense for our business to do anything with that. And we don't do that just with like Freckle apps, but the tools that we integrate Freckle with.
That makes a ton of sense. It at the end of the day, I think it all comes down to lowering the perceived risk for the customer. So a great marketing page eliminates that risk from the customer's mind. Great technical documents eliminate that risk from the technical customer's mind or the technical buyer's mind. So it might be slightly structured slightly differently, whether you're pitching to like the marketing officer or the director of marketing who's going to sign up for the product, or whether you're pitching to the engineer who's going to integrate the product with, you know, whatever it is you're building. But at the end of the day, it's about lowering that perceived risk.
Absolutely. And increasing that perceived quality, because that's another kind of aspect that we are tackling there. All right. So Thomas has prepared a spectacular outline for today's talk. So I'm going to just start working you guys through there. So Thomas declares that there are two types of technical documents we can handle. Thomas, please come in.
Yeah. So through my years of experience, I found that technical documents generally fall into two categories. You either have explanatory guides for non-technical people, or you have guides for technical people that need to implement a technical solution. That's like API docs and integration docs, and how do I hook up IMAP into Help Scout to get emails pumped through, that sort of thing.
Do you ever see these use cases collide in real life?
Not usually. Usually it's a resource thing where it's sometimes where companies will either write the guide in one form or another. If you have a really, really big company or company that's really, really nailed down their technical documents, they might explain the same technical concept or the same feature set for an app in two different sets. Like two different, like here's the non-technical explanation and then here's like the technical how you get it done part. And that, but that's a very rare exception. It's a very pleasant exception, but it's very rare.
Okay, great. So let's start with the explanations for non-technical people, so-called, you know, walkthroughs, guides, let's get it started, slideshows or whatsoever. From my experience, I can say these are often left as a second thought, like, let's do this the night before launch. Oh, we've got to have the support documentation there, you know. We've got to fill in that beginning slideshow with something. So what's the right way to tackle that so it's not like Cinderella is going home, you know?
Yeah. The best way that I found to fix the Cinderella problem is to double dip a little bit during the development process, because if you're building an app, you probably have non-technical people that are involved, whether it's support staff or sales staff or marketing. There are people who need to know how the app works in some form or another. So why don't you just go ahead and write a guide that explains that to them, and then you just have to tweak it from there to be customer facing. And you just do that as you finish up the feature while it's still fresh in your mind. And guess what? Magically, by the end, you have 80% of your support documentation done. You could probably even launch with that if you really had to, and it's better off than nothing.
Oh, absolutely. So give us more recommendations on that.
So the best way that I've found to really make great explanatory documents and guides for non-technical people is to, as I said, have an informal tone. Imagine that you're talking to someone who's really kind-hearted and who actually really wants to learn. You just need to work towards it and explain things to them. Screenshots work really well. People tend to follow through screenshots and then only read directions if something goes wrong. So having screenshots that tell the story and tell the user what to click next is extremely important. Having good formatting, doing things like bolding what the user needs to click or do next, important features. features. Putting side notes and benefits in italics, that's really helpful. One neat trick that I've seen is using clever iconography for things like keystrokes. So there are tidbits in the Freckle help docs where if you need to press like the return or the tab key, we actually have that styled to look like the Mac return or tab key. And it's just a little touch. It's a tiny little touch, but it helps the user figure out when they're scanning, okay, I have to hit return here instead of trying to read that in a paragraph. And numbered lists, of course, are always helpful. There is one thing, one sort of downside that I see people run into when doing explanatory documents, and I like to call it the Star Trek problem, where they try to explain every single bit of how something works in metaphor. And unfortunately, we are not Geordi LaForge. It's just not going to work. It tends to be too clever and it falls flat, or you end up messing up the metaphor and users have an incorrect assumption about how your app works. And then they're going to write into support angry saying like, well, why didn't this work like a, you know, car, for example, or a bicycle? Because we always use bicycles.
I remember us talking with Kai about sales copy and how you not want to be smart there.
Yeah, I'm listening to you talk about the elements that go into great technical documents, and to a T, it hits every single point that I evangelize for writing good copy. Like, hey, great, use photos and screenshots. Make sure it's well formatted. Use bold to highlight the important sections. Use icons. Use numbered lists. Make it easy to scan. Like, when I write sales copy, I go into it with the assumption that the user, the person who's going to be reading this copy, they're distracted, they're on their way out the door, they don't have a lot of time, they're going to skim it. And it seems like the steps you advocate here for creating these explanations for non-technical people, it hits the same buttons. You want to make sure that when they're reading through the document, they can skim through, find the part that's most relevant, and at a glance, see with a screenshot or with well-formatted text, the next action they need to take.
Absolutely. Kai, I wonder, you have a like rich life story. Have you ever come across support or technical docs in your life?
I actually worked at, my first job out of college was working as a sales engineer for an educational media company. And so I was brought on to be this very, very weird hybrid position where I worked with marketing, I worked with the sales team, and I worked with the web applications team as the frontline customer support. So if something technical was required, it was me. And if a customer had a question, it was me.
And did you not go crazy there?
I went crazy when we did a 5,000 person remote training with a very large school system. And the company that had built our website and our technical platform had said they had stress tested it. It did not stress test accurately. So there were 5,000 plus emails in my inbox of customers saying, great, we're here for this 3-day training. We can't do a thing. And I'm like, excellent. We're going to die. But we were able to work through it through, honestly, the principles that you advocate here and just good best practices for support. Communicating clearly, setting expectations, making sure people understand what they need to do. But one thing I discovered going into that scenario is we really didn't have robust support documentation. If something broke, we'd basically tell the customer, this is broken. And we wouldn't provide any path forward or say like, well, this is broken. Here's the alternative. Here's what you need to do to fix that. Hey, you can't get the video streaming. Well, here's the path you need to take to get the video streaming. I was creating those support documents on the fly while this scenario was happening. So it was a very trial by fire situation.
I wonder if you recall any writing tips from your standpoint, you know, you have a rich writing background. In addition to those formatting tips that Thomas said, is there any recommendation you could give on the writing itself?
I always say write it casually, write with you-focused language instead of I-focused language. When your reader is reading through it, they're going to mentally say your words to themselves. And if you're using I-focused language, I do this, I do that, it can be weird if you're using you-focused language. It feels like you're giving them instructions. So I always punt to using you-focused language, making it really clear. And stylistically, typographically, 2 to 3 sentences per paragraph. I'd much rather have a ton of paragraphs on a page than say, hey, great, here is one page that is an entire paragraph. Good luck understanding what you need to figure out.
Right. So, Thomas, back to your amazing outline. You have a point saying that there is an, contradiction between explanatory language and to the point language. So you want to be wordy, but you want to be concise at the same time. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, exactly what Kai said about having 2 to 3 sentence paragraphs for explanatory guides. That is really, really important. When he said, oh, here's a paragraph, I started, the vision started blurring. I was like, no, that's not what you need. That is the worst. Don't go that way with the explanatory documents. But there's also, there's a little bit of context when you're writing support documents as well, in that you have to realize when to talk and when to shut up, in the sense that there are times where the user just needs you to tell them exactly what to do to get on with something, and they really don't need a full-on introduction. So, for example, if they need to reset their password, or they need to update their credit card information, or they need to know where on the App Store to go download an app, you don't need to have this long kind of introduction about all of these different parts. It's really, really fine as long as you have a series of guided screenshots in a numbered list that just shows them where to click, what to do, and how to go through it, because they've done this probably dozens to hundreds of times on their own. They just don't know exactly what to click in your app. And most likely, hopefully, your app follows standard practices for how password resets and credit card updates and app downloading works. So you're just there to kind of guide them and be like, okay, you need this, go down this line, follow these steps, here's your slip of paper, you can go about your day, and let's just get back to doing great things.
Right, totally right. From my expertise, I have a lot of information how to, you know, avoid support requests altogether with successful onboarding. And the idea here, from my side of things, you know, is that you have to introduce the user to the language that's used in your app. So you need to introduce the major concepts and what they mean, but everything else like navigation, where these things are located, how you actually like find them and use them, that should be obvious from the UI. So in case you're really looking to minimize those support requests and to simplify the the support docs, you have to build the simple UI first, and it's going to seriously require less support than if you, you know, go all the way around the tree and, you know, do a really complex UI. That's going to need a very complex explanation. So, right, let's go forward to the other tips. I see that it's great to write help pages for pages like 404s, etc.
Yeah, that was actually something interesting we found out last week. I was utterly fascinated by this. We started doing some analytics on our help site, and we found that like the second or third most searched thing is an error page. Like just one of the random error pages that we have. And you would think, I mean, our error pages are pretty self-explanatory, but it just comes down to the user wanting a little bit more info. So if they get a 404, then if you see a lot of 404, like searching for something that's in your 404 error page, then you can just write up a quick little document that says, hey, this is our 404, like you must have hit our 404 error page. This is why it happened. If you think there's a mistake, then please contact our support. Basically, don't let them search for a 404 page and then hit another 404 page. That's extremely frustrating.
I imagine. I'd love to hear Kai here, how you can be, you know, smart and witty and personable with the error pages on your site, because there is plenty of information how you can use them even as your marketing tool.
Absolutely. I think that when it comes to an error page, a couple key things to keep in mind is you have two goals that seem contradictory or seem opposed to each other, but are actually complementary. On one hand, you want to make sure that the error page is explaining to the user, okay, what happened, what went wrong, what steps you need to take to fix it. But on the other hand, you also want to make sure it's very personable language, that it's speaking to them, that it's easy to read, easy to understand, and provides a next step forward. And when I've worked with people before, we've run into that problem of, well, we want to make sure our error pages tell them what they need to do, but is that communication matching up with your marketing, with your messaging, with your tone, with how you speak to your customers throughout the website? I've run into situations before of web applications where the marketing pages are very friendly and, hey, buddy, how you doing? And then I run into an error page in the app and it's like the default Rails error page. And I'm like, well, you just missed an opportunity here to talk to me like a person. Instead, I feel like I just bumped into a corner. So I think that when it comes to those error pages or 404 pages, you want to make sure that it clearly explains to the person in, you know, in friendly language, hey, this is what happened and what went wrong, but it also provides a path forward. I'm a huge fan of, on marketing sites, having those 404 pages or error pages include a clear next action for the visitor, whether it's, hey, you know what? We couldn't find the article you were searching for. Maybe you'd like this article instead, or go check out our best of page, or hey, sign up for our email newsletter. Applying that same concept to error pages within an app, well, what action would you want a visitor to take at this point? Is it contact you? Is it go read this thing? Is it go retry the search again? Making sure that you're pointing them in the right direction and then making it so there's one clear next action for them to take. Otherwise, somebody's going to hit that page and get confused and close their web browser or click the back button and try to figure out what went wrong or just get angry and give up. And any of those three are situations you want to avoid, and I think you avoid them by identifying, well, what one action do we want people to take, and how do we make sure they take it? On top of that, I'd say styling, messaging, those are good things to evaluate when it comes to these pages, making sure that if somebody ends up on an error page, it looks like the rest of your app. It's not completely different style. It's not. It doesn't feel foreign. It matches how you're presenting yourself through the application or through the marketing of your application.
Right. And from the design standpoint, error pages are the perfect location to feature any kind of, you know, animation or character, whoever you have in your app, like the chimp in MailChimp, let's say, or whatever, you know, hero you use for the app. And you can make it as fun as possible. That's where you can really unleash your imagination. And maybe you even got to be featured in Twitter just because of your fun error page. That can happen as well. And this is a very good viral marketing build-in right there. And from my project management experience, I can say that there's plenty of places involving microcopy and things like error pages, you know, titles, like button caption stuff. And it's really really easy to leave them up the launch day once again. So it will help to, in the beginning stages of your project, compile a list of your microcopy all around the app and take care of it early, or at least know that you have to take care of it. And if you're having more than one app, that list is going to serve you like forever. So you can just reuse it for your next app easily. Just to make sure you don't omit anything. So if you have a copywriter in hand, just hand it off to him and let him do his magic. One of the smartest apps I've used lately in terms of language is Edgar. They seem to make approach that super creatively, like even more than MailChimp. So for a while, MailChimp has been my hero in terms of human interaction, but I think Edgar is taking that to the even more extreme.
Absolutely, yeah. I love Meet Edgar because throughout the marketing side and the application sides, it feels clean, it feels clear, it talks to me in the same voice, in the same tone. And in the rare situation where I run into something that doesn't work as expected, it's not, you know, dropping me in a box and letting me find my own way out. It's very clearly moving me forward.
Absolutely. So enough praising Edgar. It's a great app. And now we have a point how to avoid talking down to your customers, I think.
That's the next thing, and that's something that I've seen. I saw it a lot firsthand when I was doing help desk support, and things were mainly because that was really customer facing. That was really, really customer facing, and you would have technical people, and they just kind of treated customers in this really pseudo disrespectful manner, in the sense that they didn't assume that they had any sort of knowledge, which is actually disrespectful because a lot of that knowledge, especially for non-technical people, is very hard earned. So you need to assume a level of basic knowledge from somebody. And don't worry about if somebody doesn't have a basic knowledge, because they will email your support. You don't have to try to reach out to them. They're going to reach out to you. It's just an eventuality. So don't try to write copy that works for them. The best rule of thumb that I have is to avoid sounding like a newscaster explaining how computers work. That's just a, if you start sounding a little bit like that, you know that you've fallen too far off the deep end and you need to start editing your copy, and you don't need to talk about how double clicks work or how text fields work. Just assume that they have a basic level of computer knowledge.
Right. And if you're actually talking to a customer, not in technical docs, but in a live manner, the worst thing you can do is go into the mode of a broadcaster when the person is kind of silently nodding and you're asking, like, do you get me? And he says, yes. But, you know, getting into the trick of saying yes, it's so easy because you can just not give in and admit that you're stupid there. That support person who's talking to you with a, you know, a whole tirade of technical jargon, it is a very big thing to for the customer to go through. Don't become that person with jargon.
One thing that I found works really, really well, either in face-to-face conversations like that or in technical documentation — it's a little harder in technical documentation, but bear with me — is changing the question we ask to make sure the person understands what we're talking about. So we've got two contrasting things here. We have, do you understand what I'm saying? That places the burden on the person we're explaining it to. And they have that choice of saying, yes, I understand it, which means, of course, I'm not an idiot, I get what you're saying. Or no, I don't understand it, which means I'm an idiot, I don't understand what you're saying. So I always hate the question, do you understand what I'm saying? Because it puts it on the person we're explaining it to, when if we're doing a poor job explaining it, it's our fault. It's our fault as writers or marketers or people creating these technical documents. So I love using the question, am I explaining this well? Because it suddenly removes that fear of failure on behalf of the person reading the documents. If they're reading through the documents where I'm explaining something and then say, hey, am I explaining this well? It gives them a perfect way to say, like, no, you're not, I'm not getting it, without feeling like, oh God, I must be an idiot because I don't understand it. So I really, really like making, I like putting the onus, the obligation on me to make sure I'm explaining it well, not on them or the reader to make sure they're understanding it well. Since again, if they're not understanding it, chances are it's because I wrote a crappy document, not because they are failing in some way.
Totally. And my favorite saying in regards to communication is, the result of communication is how you got perceived, not what you wanted to say. So however smart you are and whatever you want to say, it doesn't matter until you make your point across to the person. So it's totally your responsibility to make sure that you get it across well and that he really confirms that he understands it. And this is the same for communication in the marketing and family, you know, whatever. Really, it works across all different life areas. So the result of communication is the result. It's not the intention.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. You could have the best intentions in mind, but if you just do a poor job of communicating what needs to be communicated, well, it's going to be a bad result for everybody all around. I just hired an assistant, and going through the onboarding process for the assistant, I realized that like the standard operating procedures I have that I use to run my business, well, if they aren't communicating what needs to happen well, it's not their fault. It might not be my fault. We could just punt it to, it's the document's fault. And well, the next step is improve the document to make sure we're communicating everything in a good way. We aren't talking down to the person reading the document, and it makes it clear what they need to do to move forward and complete a task.
Yep. And don't be afraid to switch up formats if somebody's just not getting it. No matter if you're trying to explain it in written form and it's just not working for them, don't be afraid to switch up formats. Actually, one of my favorite little anecdotes about this is from the HBO series From the Earth to the Moon, where they're talking about building the lunar lander, and they're trying to decide, well, the engineers who are building the thing say, well, we don't actually really need seats because we're in low gravity. And they're trying to explain it to the project manager, and the project manager says, no, they need seats. They're going to be they need to need seats to land. And they keep trying to go back to him. He's just not getting it. And they say, well, let's show it to him. So they spend the whole night building a model of the lunar lander out of cardboard that's basically one-to-one size, have him walk in it. And he's like, oh, okay, now I see exactly what this is. So if somebody's not getting it in the written word, then don't be afraid to take 10 minutes to record a quick screencast to show them, hey, this is how something works, and that might work for somebody. So you might have to explain the same thing in multiple different formats.
This is...
Oh, please,
Joe. Hi. No, hi, no. Please go ahead.
It's your show.
So, yeah, it's show, not tell, most times. I would love to hear Thomas's recommendation on taking the great screenshots and taking screencasts later on. But first, I'd love to hear what guys want to say.
I was just going to ask along the same line. When does it – is there a preferred format? Like, is it better to default to screencasts versus technical documents or screenshots versus written technical documents? Does it depend on the context? Or is it better to say, hey, dear customer, you have questions – you know what? We'd love to answer it for you. You could watch this screencast showing you how to do it. You could read this document that explains the processes of how to do it. Is there a preferred format, or is it better to offer the customer the options of how they want to learn?
I think it's kind of context dependent, but the way I usually go about it is that I start with the easiest way first for both the reader and the writer. So written I find is more effective. There was a surge of doing video tutorials and video screencasts, but that can be really frustrating if that's your only way to solve the problem. Sometimes I just need a transcript to figure out this one little bit that I don't get. If in video production in a, for a customer facing sense can be kind of difficult because you got to re-record it. You got to make sure that there's no background noise and that sort of thing. So it can be a little more involved. And if you're trying to write a lot of technical documentation, that can be difficult. So I would say save that for the critical parts of your application or something that you notice a lot of customers are really struggling with. And that's when those are the points when you know, hey, I need to go out and, you know, talk to this person in this different format. To belabor the lunar lander thing, they didn't build a one-to-one cardboard replica of the entire lunar lander every single time they made an iteration. They only did that as a last-ditch effort because they knew that the project manager wasn't getting the idea.
Yeah, I'm loving that metaphor. You're just using that too smart. You're trying to explain that to us with a metaphor. All right. So for me, from my experience, taking screenshots is one of the most frustrating things to be done ever. Any recommendations on that?
Yes. I find that in OS X, it's actually pretty nice. Command-Shift-4 is really, really useful because you can just box out an area. It usually preserves the cursor and saves the state of the app. So I find that to be really, really useful. And then find the old version of Sketch. The old version of Sketch is wonderful and fantastic. If you just like start asking anybody you know who's been doing this for a while, hey, do you still have the old version of Sketch, you know, back when it was good? Because it just makes it really, really easy to annotate, and the styling, it's got a really friendly style for things like the arrows. The text is nicely formatted. It's really easy to export things. I mean, we use that all the time. I use it all the time because it's so simple and so nice to use.
No, we don't want to recommend older versions of software to our readers. Listeners, come on. Maybe something else.
I mean, you can use Preview, but that's the thing that I found have the best user experience overall. I mean, your mileage may vary, but that's something that's worked really well for me. So I think the important thing to take from that is find a tool that makes it really easy for you to annotate screenshots in, that has a little bit of personality. I think that's the biggest thing, is being able to quickly cut out a section of the screen, because you want your screenshots to be focused. So you want to be able to cut that out quickly and then quickly make some annotations and then go about your day. And for me, the old version of Sketch does that. Other people might have different tools that they recommend, but That would be my recommendation. If I was dealing with somebody who was like, okay, I need to write some technical docs, I would say, okay, you should try using this because it's worked really well for me.
I think my biggest problem has been not the, you know, media, like not the tool to do that, but actually how you select that screen area to represent it well, how to scale it, how to actually show things within, you know, a screenshot as graphic media. So more of a content question rather than tools question.
Gotcha. Okay. Let me see. The best thing that I found is to again, keep it focused, but you still want to have enough of the screen to give them, to basically center them on where they need to go. So for example, if you need to show somebody like, okay, here's where you go to your account and billing section in the navigation, then show them the entire or a good part of the navigation and then point to the part that they need to go to. Or if there's a particular button in a report that they need to click to set up an export, show them the entire button row and then show them this is the one you need to click.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's better. Thank you, Thomas. That's invaluable because, I mean, putting together that screen flow, it is not an easy job to do, seriously.
Yeah, and you don't want to just take the entire screen and try to and then annotate it from there, because the problem is those screenshots are going to be compressed. And if you have somebody who's visually impaired, then it's harder for them to see that.
Absolutely. How about we jump to the next section, which is guides for technical people, which is getting really interesting because, you know, technical people are an extremely specific audience and there must be some great advice about talking to them.
Mm-hmm. So I think the best way to think and organize your technical documents is to really understand how technical people actually read your technical documents, which is that they scan frantically for the part of the docs that they need at that moment, then they scan for the action that they need to perform, and then they scan for the info that they need to do it themselves. They actually don't want to spend a lot of time reading it. It's basically like they're just trying to burrow down and find exactly what they need to do, enough info that they need to, that they can start playing with it on their own. And it's all about rapid experimentation for them.
Right. I think that's true for all kinds of customers, actually, not just technical ones.
Yes. I think the technical people are kind of really bad about it in some ways. Like if you take a look at API docs, API docs, we're all trained to read API docs in that way. There's no fluff. It's the bare bones of, okay, here's the section of the app for the API. Here's the action you need to perform. Here are the parameters. And then usually there are code samples either before all of that explanation or right beside it. And your eye basically guides down to, okay, read here. Okay, there's the curl command I need to copy to figure out what I need to do next. And they won't, technical customers sometimes won't even give you the time of day to even consider reading your technical docs until they've reached a brick wall on their own.
Yeah, I'm yet to meet a person who'd love to read a technical doc from start to end. I think they shouldn't exist. So, you know, all the questions about formatting and scannability and everything, they apply here as good as never. Seriously.
Yeah, seriously. And I think that there are a few things that you can do to improve the usability of your technical documents and your whole technical side of your support system. Having an explicit get started section with bullet points and code samples, the whole idea being getting somebody up and running so that they can experiment on their own, is extremely important. It's basically a secondary onboarding process for your entire app.
Yeah. Do you have, like, your opinion how onboarding should be handled?
For technical documents or in general?
This is a more general question for a SaaS business.
I don't particularly have very strong opinions on it, just because I haven't had a lot of experience in doing like the user facing side of it. Technically, like if you're handling getting integrations up and running, I have some capital O opinions about that. But from in general in SaaS products, not particularly. I'm going to just state up front that I don't have enough knowledge to really have a strong opinion on that.
Do you have any stats, like what kind of problems do usually arise during onboarding that people refer to support with?
How do we add users to our account, or people who just didn't follow through? And like, how do I actually go on and create something? Like, how do I log time, or how do I create a new to-do in this, or how do I reorganize these projects? Like, they either didn't follow the tutorial, or they were just blurring through the tutorial because they were just trying to get to where they needed to go. And they didn't think, they thought, oh, this will be fine. I don't need to worry about this. I've got this under control.
Right. Do you have a practice of collecting support requests to use them in your marketing? I'm steering that towards marketing. I want to kind of take place in that conversation.
Let me see. We do at some level, we do track all of our customer support stuff. And we do end up using that for marketing. We do use our customer support info for marketing, but I don't do a lot of the work in the marketing side for the developer perspective. Like the technical docs that the doc and support stuff that I deal with, the technical side, I definitely do. I definitely find the pain points that people run into when they write in, like, hey, I need to use the API. And I'll definitely look over our documentation to see if there was some better way I could explain that.
So it's an iterative process where you're starting with your best guess, but it's sort of like that old phrase where no battle plan survives first contact with the enemy. You could write the best technical documents you think you could create, and you share them with their customers, and suddenly they're like, you're explaining this terribly. I don't understand what's going on. And you need to improve over time, and improving to answer their actual questions, not the questions you started off assuming they'll be asking.
Exactly. Exactly. That should be freeing in some sense to the idea that, okay, I don't need to get this right exactly the first time. I just need to be really good at handling customer support when it comes in, and then basically fixing that for the future. And I can do the best job that I can now, but it will get better. It will get better over time if I care about this.
Absolutely. Jumping back to Jane's question about how technical support can influence marketing, what I've coached a lot of clients on and worked with some of my clients on is trying to close that loop where a lot of my clients struggle to say, we want to create blog posts, but we don't know what to write about. And so they end up creating crappy blog posts. And my solution has always been, well, let's see what questions our customers are actually asking us. What do people write in with questions about? What do people write in furious about? And then let's take those topics and use those as the seed for articles. So if we get a ton of non-technical or technical people writing in with the same question, well, here's an opportunity to say, a lot of people have this question. Let's turn it into a blog post. And maybe the blog post is a scaled down version of the actual technical documentation you have on your site, but it serves as a quick place you could link people to, a thing that people could find publicly if your technical documents are not indexed or behind a password wall. But it just makes it easy for people who are having questions to find answers to those questions as they're searching for them. So I'm a huge advocate of taking the questions that you most frequently encounter from the technical documentation or the customer support side of things and feeding those back into the content creation process. So your blog posts, your articles, your knowledge base, your marketing pages, they're all built on those actual questions and actual pains that your customers are saying, hey, this is the issue we have. We need help with this.
Once again, we're pointing towards that fact that when people are in that very irritated, like aggravated state of mind when they're actually going out to forums and to support and asking questions, that's precisely the mood we should be capturing for our marketing copy. That's precisely where that interest begins, where you can monetize, because you know, a peaceful person will not pull out their credit card. They need to be aggravated first with a big problem, and you just want to listen up to the problems. This is the core of marketing.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think you're right that With my whole philosophy on, hey, the first step of a marketing page is to educate the person reading it on the problem they're experiencing and then present the solution that you have, going from the pain to the fix. Well, you could launch with a great idea and well-researched idea of what the pain actually is, but until you have people writing in and saying, hey, before I sign up, I have these questions, or now that I have signed up, I really have this problem, that's where you start getting more actual feedback from customers, more real world language you could use to improve the marketing side of the equation and the sales side of the equation. Flashing back to when I was a sales engineer, one thing I quickly learned was that the questions I was most frequently asked on sales calls were the questions that we needed to be answering on our marketing site. So if we were going out to talk to a school district and say, hey, these are the benefits of our product, and they hit us with the same 3, 4, or 5 questions every time, well, those are questions we need answers prepared for in terms of marketing assets we could leave behind. And those are questions we need to answer on our website. How do you integrate with this? What's the benefit of that? How do we know that this is working for us? What's your refund policy? So again, closing that loop and making sure that you're using the data collected really in all different parts here, the data that comes in through marketing, the data that comes in through sales, and the data that comes in through technical support, sharing it with each department and making sure that everybody understands, well, this is the message we want to present forward because these are the pains that the customers have. These are the pains the customers are voicing to us.
Totally. One more piece of advice should come from you, actually, is that no technical documents, no knowledge base should be hidden behind the wall. Mm-hmm. It should be indexed. It's a superior source of traffic. Am I right?
100%. 100%. So the idea there would be in terms of search engine optimization, making sure that the technical documents you have answering questions about your app, they're easily found with a Google search. They're well optimized. They follow SEO best practices and they're indexed and can be grabbed by Google. So they show up in the search results. So if somebody is a potential customer and saying, well, gee, let's pick on Freckle for a second. Well, gee, I wonder what Freckle's API is like. Can I easily integrate it with it? Can my app integrate with it? They can do a quick Google search and find out, oh, hey, these are the technical guides. I know about their API now. I could see what I can and cannot do. If you have this technical documentation or your support documentation hidden behind the paywall or the subscription wall or a login, well, now they need to register an account and go in and find it. And suddenly there's all these steps they need to do and they're going to go do something else or find somebody else to integrate with or take those steps in, start from a position of being, oh God, they made me do these 16 things before I could answer this one simple question. So you're absolutely right, Jane. I think it's a best practice to have these technical documents either for technical people or non-technical people be easily visible and found by potential customers when they're searching online.
Plus, there is one more thing. You know, your first SEO goal should be, you know, being number first result for your own search query. And if someone is going to ask a question about using your software, you really want to point them towards your knowledge base first before they go to some forum and, you know, start venting their frustration somewhere else in the third-party platform.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've been amazed the number of times I've searched for a question about or an answer to a question I have about Evernote, one of my favorite pieces of software. And the top result is the Evernote forum, which is wonderful. Tons of smart people there. But the thread is like 45 people piling on about how much they hate this feature sucks, they can't figure out how it works. And I'm like, all I want to know is how to make the text strike through. Like, I'm so happy for you folks that you're having these problems. I just really want an answer here. Can I please have an answer? So again, making sure that a customer, and I guess, yeah, thinking about it from the customer's perspective and role-playing as that customer, going out and saying, I am a new developer. I want to use the API. I have this question. I would most likely search for it this way. What search results do I see? What's that workflow like? What's that experience like for me? And making sure you're optimizing that just like you'd optimize a marketing page or your sales funnel. Somebody coming in through that direction, they have needs, they have questions. Are you presenting them with the right information?
I imagine if you have like a prominent product with a history, you can do plenty of additional work there and try to search for typical questions that arise in support and see what people are venting about in the site forums and, you know, just grab plenty of data there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, absolutely. And forums, I think, are a really, really valuable asset, both from a product development standpoint. Well, what pains and problems are our customers talking about that we could maybe integrate into our future roadmap? And from a marketing standpoint, what language are these people actually using? How could I appropriate that language and reuse it on our sales page? I think Freckle, again, is a great case study of this. Amy redid the Freckle homepage, I think around 18 months ago, based on her research into how customers were using the app, who the ideal customers were, and it led to a massive uptick in signups and a huge increase in monthly recurring revenue because the homepage, based on the support data based on the questions they got, based on the complaints and pains they got from customers, spoke directly to what their vision of a best buyer wanted and made it so somebody who was reading that sales page would nod their head along, say, this is perfect. This is exactly what I need. Here's my credit card. Let's do business together.
Yeah, this is great. Thomas, as a closing word, I'd love you to give us two pieces of advice. One is personal, about writing technical documents. And the other should be, you know, what is your best support related practice at Freckle? We just want to be you to be the, you know, the representative person for the team. So two pieces of advice from you.
Okay, so the best advice that I could have for people writing technical documents, I would really say that an informal tone that is also concise is the most crucial part. Just like marketing, being able to talk in a relatable manner to your customers does so much to handle these frustrations and diffuses the situation. If you can't talk like a human being, if they can't really empathize with the fact that there are other people on the other side of this, then they're going to always be frustrated. That was one of the things that I learned very quickly when doing help desk support and trying to come up with like standardized processes and guides for how to teach people these common problems, is that if I couldn't communicate to them as a human being, then it was going to be a frustrating process because we're dealing with a problem with a computer. So I'm just like a human proxy for the computer, and they're just going to be really frustrated about that. So being able to talk to somebody informally and have a real distinct voice is something I would say is crucial for good technical documents. And I would say that actually that's the same rule that applies for customer support. They go hand in hand. As Kai said, and as you've said, technical documents are just another form of customer support. So that is the fundamental rule for good customer support. And if you don't have a good understanding of that, no matter how many times you write a technical document, no matter how many times you format it, it will only be so effective because people will not think of you as a person. They'll just think of you as a proxy for something that is frustrating them, that has no personality, that has no sort of humanity that they can actually have a conversation with. They don't feel valued.
Great advice. Great advice. Thank you. So how about Freckle then? What's your best practice?
Best practice for Freckle is to get back to the customer quickly, get back to the customer with that personable, informal tone, and to actively work to fix the problem. That's actually one of my favorite phrases I found out as I was going through some stuff, was that my favorite phrase to use when doing customer support is, I'm actively working on this. If there's a bug, saying, I'm actively working on this, to take ownership of the problem that the customer has. Because think about the bugs and the problems that you run into in customer support. Think about all the times you run into a bug and you just decide to reload the page, or you just go decide to do something else, or you shrug your shoulder. If somebody writes into you, that took time and effort out of their day to articulate it. So first and foremost, you need to respect that, take ownership for it, and try to get an answer to their problem, because it was important enough for them to write in.
I love the active phrase that you mentioned.
It acknowledges them as a person. It acknowledges the problem that they're experiencing. And jumping back to the, am I explaining this well versus do you understand this? It, like you just pointed out, Thomas, it takes ownership of it, and it lets them know, hey, you know what? You found an issue. I'm going to take care of this. You don't need to worry about it anymore. Thank you so much for letting me know there's an issue here. I like using setting an expectation of not time boxing it, but saying like, as soon as I have an update or as soon as this is fixed, I'll reach out and let you know. I don't have a time estimate at the moment, but I'm actively working on this. It might not be like, obviously you can't have 10 number one priorities and some fixes are more important than others, but acknowledging to the customer that this is important. Thank you so much. I'm going to move forward on fixing this. I'll let you know when it is fixed. I think that helps a customer feel like I'm acknowledged. I'm valued. My contribution here was important. I'm excited to continue using this application versus so many times I sent off an email, then 3 weeks later, I get back an acknowledgement. Your support request was received. And I'm like, thank you. Thank you so much.
You'll be surprised, but so many founders, they're so immersed in daily problems, you know, their own routines, like whatever big troubles they run into, they don't have, you know, resources and energy to ask, answer support with such enthusiasm. However, this is like the frontline necessary thing that you have to do to, you know, keep your customers happy. And that's what you're working for.
I think we see a huge parallel in the consulting world where with consultants, there's the metaphor of feast or famine and the metaphor of riding the roller coaster where 1 month you're really, really focused on business development, getting new contracts. And then the next month you have a ton of work. So you're focusing entirely on satisfying those clients and customers and not doing any rainmaking, not getting any new clients. And as soon as those projects is over, oh, holy crap, I'm not making any money. What am I going to do now? We could see the parallel with the product or a SaaS where, hey, you know what? I'm focused so hardcore right now on marketing. I don't have time to do customer support. But if you're not focused on customer support, the people who have already chosen to pay you money, they're going to be left out in the dust. And suddenly you might be bringing in 2, 3, 4 new accounts a week, but losing just as many because they're reporting bugs and not hearing back from you. And your communication to them is 2 lines and terse and like, thank you, I'll look at it. And it's like, well, great. Why am I paying you $50 a month for this? If this is all I'm getting, I would expect some level of acknowledgement or positivity or thankfulness that I'm investing in your business.
Absolutely. I'd love to mention there is some kind of backwards funnel when it comes to support. So the front of the funnel, the white part is, you know, the clear to and easy to use UI UX. Whenever that's not clear, onboarding comes into effect. If onboarding fails, people refer to the knowledge base. And if they fail to learn what they need from the knowledge base, they refer to support. So if you're getting too many support requests, that's a good sign that somewhere in the top of the funnel, you have a problem. You might start with improving your UIX, or you might start with improving your onboarding or technical documentation, even though onboarding and technical docs are so often neglected. So it's a very easy way to reduce your own burden of supporting your SaaS.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Even so, I have friends who are working on their onboarding process right now. And I mean, Samuel Hulick from User Onboard is a great, great, great example of how to do it well. But you could do minimum viable onboarding very well. I have a friend with a SaaS who said, hey, you know what? I need better onboarding for people. I want to get something out there quickly. He put together a 4-page PDF that just says, you know, welcome to my SaaS. Let me walk you through what to expect, what the next steps are, what the process is, and how to ask questions. And since he's implemented that, he's seen a reduction in churn. He's seen happier customers. He's seen more put together and well thought out customer support emails. It's not, help, I have a problem. It's, hey, I read the onboarding document. My expectation was A, I'm experiencing B. Can you help me solve this? So just by taking that small step of putting together a 4-page PDF to explain, this is what to do, this is how to expect it, these are what the next steps are, it could really, really help improve the entire holistic experience throughout that customer support funnel.
Yeah, and this is a technical document 101, just, you know, starter guide for your software.
Yeah, exactly. But in that starter guide, you could hit the main points, the main questions that you've discovered people ask. People always ask me how to XYZ. Well, we don't have time to fix that feature, but we could just make sure from the get-go we're explaining to people, if you're trying to XYZ, this is what you need to do.
Absolutely. Thomas, thank you so much for sharing your professional secrets in regard to technical docs and support. It was priceless. Tell us where people can find you online.
So I actually have a great special offer for people who UI Breakfast listeners. If you go to thomascannon.me/UI Breakfast, you're going to get a course and a collection of templates, guides, and checklists I put together that are designed to help you write better technical documents today with a repeatable process. And you're also going to get this great course about customer support and how it ties into writing good technical docs and learning how good customer support works so that you can write better technical documents.
Amazing. This is like honey to my ears and to Kai's as well, because this is Kai's school right there.
That everybody should check that out. Even if you aren't writing the technical documents yourself, just signing up for Thomas's bonuses will help give you a better perspective on how it all comes together and how to think about it holistically instead of as siloed parts of a business. I recommend it for anybody who's listening.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, SaaS is not about sales. It's about keeping the existing customers happy. If you have high churn, you're not going to make any money ever. So this is worth investing into. Please go there and, you know, invest a few hours there. If you cannot hire someone, just do something yourself. Great. Thank you, friends, for joining us today. And Kai and Thomas, thank you for coming. And I hope everybody knows how to handle that perfectly. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.